Mike Downey is an attorney with Hinshaw & Culbertson, LLP, in St. Louis, Missouri. He recently spoke to several members of the Finance Core Group, Law Practice Management Section, American Bar Association, about the reasons for some ethical considerations of alternative legal fees. His comments were well spoken and directly on target for lawyers who have client responsibilities in negotiating fees before the inception of legal work.
Michael, take it away.
Well, thank you, Ed. Let me start really by saying that my focus, I think, more than anything else, is going to be on the use of alternative fees and also the reasons to move to alternative fees and some of the risks involved. There's a little brochure called Alternative Fees, Business and Ethical Issues, that I suspect we will post if this program ever becomes posted. But I think also, particularly with the size of the group we have today, it probably makes sense if people want to interact, please feel free. I'm going to loosely follow the outline, but I thought I'd start with a true story that was actually a conversation I had with an attorney who's at Abbott, used to be Abbott Labs, the pharmaceutical company. And this attorney said to me that right now they're going to a lot of the law firms that they've been partnered with for a long time, and they're asking those law firms about alternative fee arrangements. And what they're really looking for is firms that are interested in doing alternative fee arrangements are also those firms that they expect they will be moving forward with some sort of convergence process with. So it's sort of, if you're willing to work with them on how you charge for your fees, you may actually be in the position to continue to do work with them. The suggestion, of course, also being that those firms that say, we're sorry, all we do is hourly billing at our fixed rates, and that's the only chance we'll give you, are going to have trouble, at least with some clients, in maintaining those relationships. So it's kind of interesting at the outside. There's been a lot of discussion. I know that there's been articles on taming the billable hour, and there's a declaration the billable hour is dead, and there's been lots of things like that. I think that most of those are sort of like the announcement of Mark Twain's death, which was a bit exaggerated. I think the billable hours now account for about 70 to 80% of all legal billings. Contingency fees are the next largest chunk, and people usually put those at somewhere about 10 or 15%. And after that, there's a smattering of other things. Some practices, for example, a trust and estates practice, a lot of the work on a small trust and estates practice will be fixed fee. In certain other things, you'll see other types of variations, but certainly at this point, the bulk is the hourly billing. And what I started off with the outline on is really just sort of trying to drive home two points. The first is lawyers will sometimes think, well, if I go to an alternative arrangement, I can make more money. And that actually is true. And in fact, we'll talk a little bit about how you can actually make more money doing things you do all the time and do it in a proper and ethical fashion. That having been said, the big rule, first of all, is that you can't charge an unreasonable fee. So you see I've got there just the language from Rule 1.5A. And it's important to realize how expansive this is. It says that lawyers shall not make an agreement for, charge, or collect an unreasonable fee or an unreasonable amount for expenses. And obviously what they're trying to do there is they're trying to capture really any sort of arrangement that would result in an unreasonable fee. It's worth also mentioning here, people sometimes ask, when is the reasonableness of a fee determined? And a lot of times people say, well, you know, I entered a contingency arrangement at the outset it seemed reasonable, but then it became a very easy case. That's okay, right? And what I would comment there is I don't often see disciplinary action taken against a lawyer who enters a one-third contingency fee, sends off a demand letter that takes an hour and receives back a very generous settlement offer that the client ultimately accepts. That having been said, if you look at the rule, it talks about both making an agreement for and collecting the unreasonable fee. So it suggests that it has to be reasonable throughout the representation. What you will see, and we'll talk about these a little bit later, are there are cases where people get in trouble for contingency fees, but normally there's some other circumstances involved. And in particular, they normally become a problem when the only people getting paid really are the lawyer and sometimes the doctors, and the lawyer's becoming rich at the expense of an injured client who's really getting nothing from the case. So the second quote that I have there is actually from the South Dakota Supreme Court case, In re Dorothy, and you'll see there also I quote to the Swartz decision out of Arizona. But it's an interesting comment on sort of where we are with fees. I do a lot of ethics and risk management, and I teach it, and one of the things that I really have learned to try to emphasize to people is that we are fiduciaries of our clients, that we serve as their agent, that we have the ability to go into court and speak on their behalf. And with this comes a whole series of obligations, including obligations of candor and loyalty, and the notion that you need to, in many circumstances, put the interests of your client first. Although I think a lot of lawyers grasp that in for example, how they're going to handle a representation or whether a case should settle, it's important to realize that those fiduciary obligations do melt back into the business relationship. And you'll see here the quote from these Supreme Court cases, and there's other case law along this as well, that emphasizes a fee agreement between a lawyer and a client is not an ordinary business contract. Although the lawyer is certainly free to consider his or her own interests, the primary concerns are those of the clients. And it goes on to say in the unhighlighted part that fees must be reasonably proportional to the services rendered and to the situation presented. So clearly the South Dakota Supreme Court, as most courts would do, say that lawyers have a right to earn a wage and to get compensated for the work they do. But there's sort of this word of caution here that the lawyers who seek to effectively fleece their clients are being told, don't go there. Now, what do we use to consider whether or not a fee is reasonable? And the model rules, Rule 1.5A, has 8 factors. And I've listed them there, and you'll see it's time and labor required, likelihood the work will preclude other employment, fees customarily charged in the locality, amounts involved, time limitations imposed, the nature and length of the relationship, the experience and reputation of the attorney, and whether the fee is fixed or contingent. There's a couple of interesting things to realize here. The first is the notion of looking at time spent, which is what we usually use when we're talking about hourly billing or time-based billing, is only one-third of the first of those components. So when you talk about time and labor required, that's one thing. The second part of that very same factor is novelty and difficulty of the work, which isn't necessarily reflected in an hourly fee. Now, it may impact it because the lawyer may say, I charge a higher fee because it's very novel work that I do. But a lot of times, the lawyer is going to charge the same fee no matter what they're doing. So it's kind of funny to realize, as you look at these factors, certainly time and labor is a part of what can be used to consider when determining if a fee is reasonable, but it's certainly not the only part. There are several factors, meanwhile, that really have to be ignored in hourly billing. For example, you talk about things like the amount involved in the results obtained, the fourth factor. Normally, that's not going to be reflected in hourly fee engagement. Now, a lawyer may say, I'm going to quote this client a higher fee because it's such a big case, but a lot of lawyers will charge the same fee, whether it's a big case or a small case or anything else, and clearly that would be outside of this. Now, this also suggests maybe a discount for a small case is appropriate, but it's interesting to realize that doesn't really fit. Things also like the nature and length of the client relationship may or may not be something that's reflected in a time-based billing. Time limitations imposed are probably not going to be reflected. And whether the fee is fixed or contingent certainly suggests that you're looking at something other than the hours that will be spent doing the work. So the factors themselves at least suggest not only is it ethical, but sometimes there may be other things that you really should impact those fees. So, but that having been said, there's a couple of things to really know about doing alternative billing. The first is for an awful lot of lawyers, it really does require a change in thinking. And I've talked with a lot of lawyers who will say to me, and the common refrain, I'm a litigator, and you never know how litigation is going to be, so it's impossible to charge a fixed fee, or it's impossible to charge any sort of alternative fee. The only thing I can say to that is that there are lawyers out there doing it, there are law firms out there that are doing it, and sometimes they're doing it successfully. If you have a sense of about how long a matter will take, you can set a fee. Now, you realize in doing that you're taking a risk that it will take more time, and the client's taking a risk that it will take less time, and you may get a totally different level of compensation. My favorite story that goes along with this, after the ABA Journal published its article about alternative fees are the way to go and time-based billing is dead, there was a 91-year-old lawyer from Vermont that wrote in a letter, and he said, I've been doing the same type of billing for years, which is basically value billing that we'll talk about in just a minute. And he said, I'm glad to know now that I've kept doing the same thing long enough that I'm back on the cutting edge. And the suggestion there was that time-based billing is something that wasn't really done until the 1950s and 1960s, and it's not the only way to bill clients. I've talked with lawyers and worked with lawyers who will do, for example, they charge their client a fixed fee for every deposition, a fixed fee for every motion or response, a fixed fee for letters. Obviously, then some letters take longer or shorter time. Some motions may take more or less. But the client knows if we talk about it, we say, let's file a motion for summary judgment. The lawyer says, well, a motion for summary judgment is going to be $5,000. The client then knows exactly what they're paying for that. And the lawyer then has a real motive to get it done quickly, to get it done efficiently, to use more junior lawyers at the law firm, maybe to outsource some of the work or use paralegals, all of those types of things to make sure that $5,000 is a good value for themselves and also for the client. So this comment from the partner, it wouldn't be fair to charge two clients the same if one client's work took much longer, is a true quote that I actually heard someone say when we were talking about this. But it sort of shows also that you need to be willing to move away from that.
So, well, Mike, let me ask a couple of questions.
Sure.
One is, if you charge a fixed fee,
yes,
does that mean that when you are going to Chicago for a deposition, on the airplane you can do work for somebody else without violating the rules of professional conduct because you're not charging by the hour, and therefore it's not you're not really charging the same minute to two different clients?
Absolutely.
Okay, and
absolutely.
Also...
And just as a very real example, a fair amount of the work that I do, I'm paid by the day, and I'll, you know, fly to some place and do work there and then fly back. And a lot of times we'll do a fixed fee. I'll say, you know, you get one day of my services and it's going to cost X amount. I may do work prior to getting on the airplane to get ready to go down there, but when I'm going down, I'm often doing work for a different client because I'm ready to go.
Okay, so you're...
I do work.
But you're not charging by the day then, are you? You're charging a fixed fee for the...
No, actually, I'm charging by the fixed piece of work. You're right.
But, yeah, because if you're charging for the day, then you're in the same conundrum.
Exactly. What I'm doing is I'm saying you'll get you know, 6 hours of programs, which will last, you know, which will take me a day to present.
Okay. And the other part of it where you've got a fiduciary duty to the client is a real problem for me in that it's always a look back. And a great example of this is in the mass tort cases where the lawyers may be getting millions or even billions of dollars. But if you looked at it going forward, you'd say, well, but for the lawyer being willing to take it on a contingency basis, that claim would never have been presented. And yet people are always upset about the high lawyer fee after the fact. So how do you deal with that? Do you tell your client, hey, go get another lawyer to take a look at my fee agreement?
No, I mean, that's exactly the situation that we were talking about before of sort of the need to look both ways. Courts that have looked at this, and when I say courts, I mean courts that have reviewed the fees, for example, in class actions or anything where the court's involved in approving a fee, the payments to the lawyers, but also in circumstances where discipline claims have been brought. When they look at the contingency fees, they'll look at them and they'll usually say, in the vast majority of cases, you took this mass torts case, you knew you'd be incurring a lot of expenses, you weren't sure when the case would settle. In this type of case, particularly when you look at some of the other factors, things like what's customary in the industry, they're very willing to say a one-third contingency was appropriate here. And the fact that you ended up recovering $100 million and got paid $33 million of it, while that's a big fee, that's kind of part of the arrangement. Where they have problems are where, and I'll actually just go ahead and deal with it now. It's part of the outline. There's a reference to the Swartz case. Swartz is an interesting case, and I'll go ahead and give you the facts so you can kind of see how the court arrived at where it was. It's a case in which the client was injured. The client also had a workers' compensation claim, and they recovered about $150,000. $50,000 of that went to the lawyer. Basically, the entire other 100%, $100,000, went to pay the doctor's bills. And the court was clearly in part upset that the client received basically nothing. The court found an excessive fee there, and if you look at the language in the Sun, it's down on page 3 of the outline. The court actually says there was, in short, no contingency, no difficult problem, and little work. There was also no result for the client. And it said there, in these types of circumstances, the one-third contingency is not proper. And I think, Ed, what your comment really goes to and what when you look at the court decisions, what often happens is I hear comments around St. Louis of, oh, a 40% contingency fee is a normal contingency fee. And then that sort of becomes a rule that people say if you can always charge a 40% fee. If you look at how the ethics opinions really say it, it's, well, 40% is an appropriate fee in certain types of cases. There was a recent case that I apologize, I don't remember the jurisdiction, but it may have been New York, where they approved a 50% contingency fee. But they said, well, the reason we approved this 50% contingency fee is this was a very difficult case. It was expected to take a lot of work, and several other attorneys had already passed on the case because they didn't think that it would be worthwhile for them to do it. So the fact that a lawyer finally took it suggested it was worth more. The problems are more where the lawyers come in and they know, if I spend an hour writing a letter, we're going to get a nice settlement and the client's going to be happy. And they turn around and say, for that hour, I'm expecting to get paid $2 million. And if you're going in with that type of attitude, if I can always charge 33% because that's acceptable, you have to be very careful, because what you're not doing there is you're not paying attention to the needs of the client.
Well, so at what point can you say this is a matter of personal contract? I remember the adage, or whatever the appropriate word is, for the guy who calls the great lawyer in Washington, D.C., and asks Williams, you know, Edward Bennett Williams,
sure,
to help him out. And Williams makes a phone call. It gets the value for the client and sends him a bill for $25,000. Of course, in today's world, it would be a lot higher.
Sure.
And the client calls him back and says, wait, you just made one phone call. And Williams' response was, yeah, but what did I do for you?
Yeah.
Now, that probably would be overturned in your context.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, that's the interesting thing about it. When you talk about alternative billing, if Williams said to the guy, I'm going to take care of your problem, it'll cost you, you know, $25,000, and he made one phone call and took care of the problem, that may be fine. I mean, that's an important thing to realize here, is that you have to totally disengage your thinking from how much time it took when you get into alternative billing.
Yeah, but I don't know that the court is willing to do that on a regular enough basis, because, first of all, in the way the story goes, Williams never put the number up before.
Sure.
Before he made the phone call, because he didn't know what he was going to do.
That could be a real problem, and that's something that we're going to talk about as well.
Okay. So, I mean, you've got that problem. But
exactly.
What you're saying also is that now the lawyer has no real guidelines, because he's always going to have to, or she's always going to have to, defend. And if you look at the 6, 7, or 8 factors in the rule of professional conduct, time is always number one on the list.
Well, but time is only part of number one. And I would actually say time, we have conditioned ourselves to believe that time is always number one. I'm going to go ahead and let me give you an example and then talk about the 5 different types of alternative billing as I've sort of arranged them. You asked before about sort of the double billing for the same time. And there's an ABA ethics opinion that talks about it. It's opinion 357. Can a lawyer... Say a lawyer is asked to prepare a document for a client. It takes 10 hours to prepare. The lawyer charges $300 an hour. If he's doing time-based billing, the lawyer can clearly charge $3,000 for that document, and we presume that's a reasonable fee. That's fine. Second client comes up and needs the exact same document drafted. Lawyer spends an hour or 2 hours updating it. Can the lawyer then charge the second client $3,000 for the same document? And on time-based billing, the answer is clearly no. If you tell someone, I'm going to bill you $300 an hour, and you only spend 2 hours on the matter, you can't bill them anything other than $600 without some sort of special agreement. But here's the alternative. The second person comes to you, and you don't say to them, I'm going to charge you $300 an hour. You say, I'll prepare the documents you want me to prepare. It's going to cost you, and there's some reasonable value for those documents. It may be $5,000. It may be $3,000. It may be $2,000. As long as whatever value you give him is reasonable, you're fine. Now, if Bennett said, how valuable is this? And the person said, my business will not survive without this being permitted. And William says, I'll take care of it. It's going to cost you $100,000. And the client says, great. If you can take care of it, I'll pay you the $100,000. And Bennett then makes the call. And the call takes care of the problem. There's a very good chance that if Bennett and the client have talked about it ahead of time, the client's going to say, here's your $100,000. I'm thrilled you took care of it. There's also the chance that the client's going to say, I can't believe you charged me $100,000 for a phone call. And Bennett's response should be, we agreed it would be $100,000 to take care of this matter. I made one phone call, and I got lucky that it was taken care of. This could have taken me a lot more than that. And the reason I told you $100,000 was because when you look at all of those other factors, including the amount involved and how valuable it was to your business, you needed this done. And there's a very good case law example of this, which is the Brobeck case, where a law firm, and I was the great now deceased Brobeck firm was engaged to handle a Supreme Court appeal. And they said if it reaches a certain point, it's going to be $1 million fee. Well, it reached that point. They argued they were entitled to $1 million, although the case was settled before any of the briefs were ever filed. And the court there said that in light of what you wanted done, it was reasonable to charge $1 million. And one of the things the court looked at was they said, by getting Brobeck involved and by getting the particular lawyer from Brobeck involved, you were able to get the result you wanted, which was a settlement on terms you could live with. And if no major firm had taken this, and if, you know, Mike Downey filed your petition for writ of certiorari, you probably would not have been able to get the same settlement. The fact that you had Brobeck willing to take your case to the Supreme Court and have, you know, a lawyer who had represented the Oakland Raiders in the suit against the NFL take your case made your case more palatable to settlement to the other side. So, I mean, I would say Bennett's problem was not that he tried to charge someone $25,000, but that he didn't tell the person it's going to be $25,000. And I'm not sure how long it's going to take me, but no matter how long it takes me, I'm only going to charge you $25,000. And if he had presented it better to the client probably would have written the check and not even worried about it. You know, if somebody comes to your house and says, I'll put on a back porch and it's going to be $40,000, and they put on the back porch and it's what you want, and they send you the bill for $40,000, generally you pay it. And when they say it's going to be $40,000, they take the risk it's going to be more work and effort than they thought, and you take the risk that they may be getting sort of a super premium from you, but that's a risk you're both willing to take. And we as lawyers have become so ingrained always looking at the time involved that we lose track of that's only part of one factor.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that the first example that you gave of the back porch or the, you know, construction of the Statue of Liberty or Rockefeller Plaza, what have you, is perhaps the appropriate way to go. And the courts still, though I think this is changing, and I think it will change based on economic reality, are still focusing in on the time. And they're not allowing the client and the lawyer to negotiate their own deal. And they're using rubric such as fiduciary relationship to get in the way. Because in reality, at least in my opinion, there is no fiduciary relationship established in the beginning. You are two independent parties and have the rights of contract to determine whether that fiduciary relationship will be created. Now, if it's created, that's fine, but that's sort of after the fact.
Well, there are clearly also some impacts that the prospective fiduciary relationship has with confidentiality and other things. But I would say that certainly you are correct to a point, although if a fiduciary bamboozles their client into entering a relationship on very unfavorable terms, I think their excuse later of, oh, we weren't fiduciaries at that time, is not going to help them very much.
Well, you're using a loaded emotional word,
exactly.
Word when you're saying bamboozle.
Exactly.
I'm just talking about arm's length negotiations between a lawyer and a client or prospective client.
Let me mention an interesting case, though, that sort of suggests that things may be more complicated than you think. There's a case out of Massachusetts called In re Fordham, like the school. In re Fordham, a man was looking for a lawyer to represent his child on effectively a driving while intoxicated. It's operating a vehicle under the influence or something like that claim. And ends up talking with a woman who suggests her husband, who's a good lawyer. The husband calls and says, I've never handled this type of case before, but I'm happy to do it, and quotes him an hourly fee. The lawyer ends up ultimately winning the case and does some things that were can perceived even by the Massachusetts court as, quote, being novel. And ends up, though, billing about $50,000 to the client. And the client protests and says that's not fair. Now, the opinion presumes, and it appears that this is accurate billings by the hour. So this is not a situation where the guy inflated his time or anything else. He really spent a lot of time on it, and it ends up it's $50,000. In contesting the bill, the ethics authorities come in, and they say this appears to be an excessive fee. And they actually bring in experts that testify that for an operating under the influence claim, defense, it should be about $10,000 or $15,000. And the court actually disciplines the lawyer and says, even though you accurately billed your time, it's still an unreasonable fee in light of what you were doing. Now, when I teach the case, I always mention to people, it's kind of odd that this guy did novel work and actually won the case, whereas for most people, if you get a lawyer to represent you on a driving under the influence, you're probably going to get not very novel work, and you're probably going to end up with some sort of penalty against your license. But that having been said, the court looked at it and said, even though you did things accurately, if you look at the fee customarily charged, that third factor, that's going to prevent you from billing accurate time. And it's interesting to realize that there are not a lot of cases out there. I'm not saying it happens all the time, but lawyers really do need to rethink how they're viewing their clients when it comes to negotiating fees and also in collecting fees.
Mike, I want to bring us to a close because I don't want to impose on you
Sure. For
this purpose. And probably your last admonition is the appropriate place to stop, recognizing that lawyers do have to be very careful when they enter the arena of negotiating fees with prospective clients.
Sure.
And so on behalf of the group, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. And let me just mention real quickly before I go, we had talked kind of at the outset, and I wanted at least to mention at the end, Rule 1.5, comment paragraph 4, talks about the need for the client to understand how they'll be billed and what they'll be billed. This is, I think, a mistake lawyers make in all of their relationships, hourly and non-hourly. If the client understands, if I handle this case on hourly fee, it's going to be $100,000 at the outset, you're in a far better relationship than you are if you tell them it's going to be $250 an hour when you know it's going to end up being $100,000, because they have no idea how much those fees are going to add up to. And it's far better for them to say you're too expensive than for them to get in problems and end up really fighting you later on in the relationship. So, but thank you very much, Ed, and thank you everyone else on the phone.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.